I'm going to wander ahead here, and, you know, I'm the guy that's going to introduce the speaker, but first I want to introduce somebody else. I think it was maybe 20 years ago, there was a guy by the name of Bill Isaac, and he had a back problem. He went to chiropractor. The way he found the chiropractor was in the Yellow Pages. Kind of interesting. And treated and released. Then he went back a little while later, maybe a couple years later, had a shoulder problem where he fell down. Chiropractor treated and released, and Bill did pretty well. Well, then he started dating the chiropractor, and she is here today. It's Mrs. William Isaac. Christine, would you please stand?
Please stand. Come on.
That's my last story for the day. Well, maybe I can come up with one more. Pleasure for me to introduce our speaker today. I've known Bill for a few years. He comes to us primarily as his former position as chairman of the FDIC. And during his tenure, he solved many problems. Over 3,000 banks and SNLs failed at the time that he was in that job. If you fast forward the 900 of those that were banks to today's dollars, do times six, you know, the way you play the numbers, that would have exceeded what happened in 2008 when your government did the TARP program, which some people don't think was that effective. So Bill has had a lot of experience, and I know he can tell us a few tales. He became a director on the board at age 33. It wasn't until a few years later, at age 37, that he became the chairman of the FDIC, probably the youngest ever at that time. I hope all of you received our newsletter. Did you read the newsletter? Did you read the bio? I'm not going to comment on things in the bio, okay? So, anyhow, Bill has a pretty darn good career in that business. He also, I'm going to say now and I'll say again, he recently wrote a book, you know, as a service to members, why we do have authors that will have their book with them after these meetings are over. And I'm going to mention the book now before Bill gets you fired up, because I think he will kind of get your spirits raised a little bit. The name of the book, think of this, Senseless Panic, How Washington Failed America. Now, how's that for a good start on a presentation, okay? With that, I give you my friend Bill Isaac. Bill?
Thank you, Dave. And you know, I'm just overwhelmed to see this many people at a. Can you hear me? Is it working? Actually, this should be working. Can you hear me back there? Okay. All right. I'm really delighted to be here. And Dave and Ann have been gracious hosts. And I've met a lot of the board members, if not all of them. And what a great organization! I just was surprised to see this many people come out for a luncheon on a weekday. It's a great organization you have put together here, and you have every right to be proud of it, and I hope I'll do justice. You've had a lot of great speakers, and maybe I can at least be a footnote somewhere in among the speakers you've had. I thought I would tell you a little bit about myself to begin, and then I'll talk about where's that book? It's here. I'll talk a little bit about what caused me to write this, and you know what it was like to deal with the '80s, and what I felt when I watched our government screw up the latest crisis and turn it into a panic. So I'll talk about that, and I would like to stop reasonably short. I don't want to talk forever because I really would like to get as much Q&A as possible. I think they said they're going to have cards on the table. So write down your questions. I think people will be collecting them, and Dave tells me he's going to decide which ones I can address. But I would also add that if you have a question and you didn't send in the card, if you raise your hand, I'll try to acknowledge as many of those as I can, because I really would like to have an active Q&A. These are difficult times for our country. I don't need to tell you that. It's a scary time for our country, and I thought I was through, went through the fire in the 1980s, and I did. I mean, it was a very difficult period in the '80s, but we're running out of bullets this time around, and and the problems aren't getting better, they're getting worse. So I'm spending a lot of, I spent much of the past 3 years out talking to people and on TV, on radio, newspaper, in person at different events, and writing articles. And I would mention to you, I have a website called williamisaac.com. And go to it, because there's always a lot of new stuff on it. And everything I've been talking about for the past 3 years, or interviews that I've done the past 3 years, is on it. And it really, I'm really trying to get people educated on what's going on in our economy and with our government. And hopefully we get enough people worked up enough about it that in 2012 we have a revolution at the polls. We really need... So let me tell you about this revolutionary who's up here. I'm come from a very small town in Ohio. And by the way, I saw a little bit ago Lloyd Liggett. I don't see him right now, but Lloyd Liggett's in the audience. And he and I grew up in Bryan, Ohio, small town, about 7,000 people in the northwestern corner of the state. And I went to Miami University for undergraduate. Yeah, and Lloyd was my roommate the freshman year. Which I'm sure he didn't enjoy. and I got to know his dad later. His dad was the head of the one of the largest banks in Cincinnati, and a really great guy. And so I saw Lloyd. I see a lot of people that I know from my days, and I've been over 40 years in the banking industry. For example, Sam over here, McCullough from Meridian in Pennsylvania, and I see bankers all over the room, including Dave, that I know from. It seems like my whole past is coming back to haunt me in this room. And then I went to law school at The Ohio State University, and I know there's got to be a lot of Buckeyes here. and my first job was as a lawyer with a very large law firm in Milwaukee. I was there 5 years, decided it was too cold and I didn't really want to practice law the rest of my life. So I, about after being up there, was it 5 years? I think I was there, 5 years. And I took a job as general counsel and a few other things for the largest bank in Kentucky, which was First Kentucky National, also known as First National Bank of Louisville, where I was for 4 years. And then Jimmy Carter appointed me to the FDIC board in 1978. I was 34 when I took that position. It's a bipartisan board. I was a Republican member. I thought I would stay 2 years and then go back to the private sector, because I didn't think it would be very fun for very long to be a minority board member on a small, sleepy agency. Because the FDIC really didn't have anything to do hadn't had much to do since the Great Depression. Well, fate was in the wind, because Ronald. First of all, we had stagflation, serious stagflation. The economy was stagnant in the Carter years. Inflation was out of control, much like where we are today. It feels an awful lot like that right now to me. And Jimmy Carter appointed Paul Volcker chairman of the Fed in 1979 with the mandate to get inflation under control, which he did but at great cost to the financial system and the economy. And by the way, Paul Volcker wrote the foreword to this, and the foreword itself is well worth reading. Don't skip over the foreword. Paul Volcker's a great guy, and I was very happy to have him. I was touched by the foreword he wrote. But in any event, then Ronald Reagan, much to everybody's surprise, defeated Jimmy Carter, and the Republicans were now in control of the White House, and they had a choice of either keeping the Democrat who was chairman of the FDIC on board, or naming this guy Bill Isaac, who they didn't know, who was a young Turk, to be chairman. And I think they debated that for quite some time. Finally decided that I was probably the lesser of two evils, so Ronald Reagan named me chairman of the agency. I think I was 36 then, and I served. I had a 6-year term, and I actually served 8 years. So I I went there when I was 34, and I was all washed up when I was 42. And since then, I have been consulting. I started a consulting firm of my own, and I sold it about 4 years to another firm, and then a much larger firm acquired it this year. And I'm now global head of financial institutions for FTI Consulting, which is a firm of about 4,000 professionals operating in 26 countries. So that's what I do now in my day job. I have time to be chairman of Fifth Third Bank Corp, and there's a Fifth Third table around here. Hi there. About a little over a year and a half ago, Fifth Third asked me if I would join the board as chairman. They decided to separate the chairman and CEO roles, which I think was really brave and farsighted of them. No matter who they put in the chairman's role, I'm not trying to take credit for that, but I would say I truly believe that separating the chairman and CEO roles in banking institutions is very important to give the board a greater sense of independence from management. So anyway, Fifth Third took the brave step of doing that, and so for the last year and a half, I've been chairman of the board of Fifth Third Bank Corp as well. I live in Sarasota, Florida, with Christine, and that's our residence, our full-time residence. We have two children, ages 10 and 9, that we just adore. They're fabulous kids. The 10-year-old's name is Lennon, as in John Lennon, and the 9-year-old is Quinn. She's a fabulous musician, and Quinn is a fabulous tennis player, and they're both just great kids. So that's who you have up here. I would tell you that the book came about was I was sitting in Sarasota, Florida, watching all this activity go on with the financial system, and just beside myself with I was aghast to watch the government mishandling this crisis we were faced with. It should never have gotten out of control. It was easily containable. I think we had far, far worse problems in the 1980s in the economy and in the banking system than they had this time around. And the difference is that we handled it right back then. We did not create a panic. We handled things in an orderly way. The government, the public got the sense that somebody was in charge who knew what they were doing. And this time around, that sense was not created. And I'll go into that a little bit, and then I'll go to Q&A. The first one to go down. Well, let me talk about the 80s before I do that, and then I'll get back to modern day. In the 1980s, Paul Volcker raised the prime rate to 21.5%. Now I can tell you that's going to blow a hole in anybody who has a contract for any kind of financial contract. No bank was anticipating when they made a loan to Bill Isaac at 6% or 7% that he was going to have to service a loan at 21.5%. So nobody could factor that into their credit decisions. So every bank had a problem. And a lot of their contracts were fixed rate contracts, and they couldn't change the rate. So the bank was in trouble if it couldn't change the rate, and it was having to pay in the teens for its deposits, its funding, and couldn't raise Bill Isaac's rate above 6 or 7%. So the banks were, and that was the S&L problem. They were bleeding. They were hemorrhaging red ink. And then if the bank could raise the rate, Bill Isaac couldn't handle it. So that was what was going on throughout the entire financial system and throughout the entire economy. The first ones to get hit hard were the mutual savings banks in New York. They're like New England. They're like S&Ls, but they were historically different, and those were the FDIC's direct responsibility. FDIC didn't have responsibility for the S&L industry at that time, but we did have responsibility for the savings bank industry, which was just as large as the S&L industry. Now, you've never heard of the savings bank industry problems, or not? You probably hadn't heard much about them because we handled them well. And we got out of the savings bank industry was underwater, if you marked them to market, for $100 billion at that time. And we had an $11 billion FDIC fund. And we got out of those problems for a total loss over a period of 4 or 5 years of $2 billion. That was just amazing to be able to navigate that, but we did. The SNL industry, they totally messed up on that. They let it get out of control, and they turned it into $150 billion of taxpayer losses. And if you convert that to today's dollar, it's about $900 billion that we taxpayers lost, in today's dollars on the SNL industry. But in any event, the second thing to hit was the agriculture. We had very high inflation in agriculture. Land prices were going through the sky. Crop prices were going through the sky. Food prices were going through the sky. And all of a sudden, it came to a screeching halt. And farm income dropped from $90 billion a year to something on the order of $10 to $20 billion a year, way down. Just the bottom fell out. It was a depression in agriculture, and it affected hundreds and hundreds of community banks around the country. The next thing that hit was the collapse of the energy sector, total collapse. It was really, as you know, in the late 80s, and we had gas lines and everything else, and there was a lot of inflation in the energy industry. That collapsed somewhere around 1982. The ag situation hit in 81. In 82, the energy situation hit. And oil rigs, which used to be selling for a premium, were worth 10 cents on the dollar if you could find a buyer. And the FDIC wound up owning a lot of oil rigs. The next thing that happened was we started to have a serious real estate recession that sort of rolled around the country. It began in the Southwest with all the banks down in Texas, Oklahoma, New Mexico, and so forth. And then it went out to California and the West Coast. And then it rolled over to Florida and the Southeast. And then it went up to the Northeast. And then finally it settled down in the Mid-Atlantic states. The Midwest didn't get hit too hard because there hadn't been as much speculative growth in that area. But we had a massive real estate recession that went around the country, wiping out banks left and right. We lost, as Dave mentioned in the introduction, we lost 3,000 banks and thrifts during the 1980s, but including many of the largest in the country. 9 out of the 10 largest banks in Texas failed. Can you imagine that? 9 out of the 10 largest banks in Texas failed. You had banks like Southeast Bank here in Florida that failed. Bank of New England failed. Security Pacific and First Interstate didn't fail, but they disappeared because they were so weak. They were acquired. SeaFirst out in the state of Washington failed. So we, you know, just all over the Continental Illinois was the 7th largest bank in the country, failed in Chicago. So all over the country, we were dealing with very large bank and thrift failures in big numbers. At the end, by the way, only 400 banks have failed this time. I mean, we think it's a big deal, but only 400 banks failed, and they aren't very big for the most part. Right now we have, I think the problem bank list, the FDIC's problem bank list, topped out at 900 this time. It's down in the 800s now. Well, in the 1980s, in 1991, after we had already suffered 3,000 bank and thrift failures, we still had 1,500 on the problem bank list after 3,000 had already failed. So I'm trying to give you a sense of how massive that problem was. And I haven't mentioned yet that the largest banks in the country, the city banks, the chemicals, the Morgan Guarantees, and so forth, were loaded to the gills with loans to third world countries. The LDC debt problem, lesser developed countries or something, to be polite. They were loaded to the gills with them, and we were deeply concerned that these countries were going to start defaulting on those loans. And had they, we had put a standby plan in place, we were going to nationalize all the major banks in the country if the third world country started defaulting, at which we thought was a very serious risk. So we were, that's how serious it was. We were on the edge of nationalizing the largest banks in the country. So I tell you that, and then I look at this problem, which was basically a subprime lending problem in real estate. And I can't figure out how it got so bad. I mean, I was sitting there just beside myself, the anguish I felt watching this go on, because it was a problem that should have been containable if they had simply not panicked everyone. Now, how did they panic us? Well, remember Bear Stearns came along, and the Federal Reserve loaned Chase $30 billion on a non-recourse basis and said, be the lender to Bear Stearns so it has liquidity so it won't fail. Chase said, okay, and they did it. Then a couple days later, I don't know, for some reason, I don't understand why, the Fed thought better of that and merged Bear Stearns into J.P. Morgan Chase. I'm not sure why that happened. I thought it was a sweetheart deal, and I think there probably had to be something better to do than that. But I would have just kept the liquidity lines going until the crisis was passed and then sort out the wreckage. But in any event, that's what they did. And the market sighed a sigh of relief. Then Lehman comes along, Lehman Brothers, and what'd they do? Everybody's expecting, of course, they're going to take care of it like they did Bear Stearns. But inexplicably, they let it fail. They let it slide into bankruptcy, and that created this worldwide panic in the markets. There was more to come, but that was the turning point. Paulson at the time, Secretary of Treasury Paulson at the time said, he was quoted in the newspaper saying, I was not going to be known as the Secretary of Treasury who bailed out all of Wall Street. So it was an intentional decision to let it go down so that he wouldn't be painted as a bailout guy. Okay? Today what he says is, we didn't have the authority. And the Fed says that too. We didn't have the authority. What's the difference between Bear Stearns and Lehman? I can't figure it out. But if you're not convinced that there is no difference, if you aren't, let's talk about what comes next. AIG, humongous insurance company, it was once the largest financial institution in the world, based on the market cap of its stock. It gets in trouble. What's the government do? The Fed loans them $80 billion. The collateral was stock in the company. Not exactly a central banker's loan. So what's this that you didn't have authority to help Lehman, and you could take over ownership of AIG? I mean, it just doesn't wash. And the reason why Paulson doesn't want to own that Lehman decision, that he made a conscious decision to let it go down, is because it turned out so badly. It was horrible. And I think everybody believes it was a huge mistake to let Lehman go down. But they did. Then they come along and they bail out AIG. They spent 6 months telling us that Fannie and Freddie were in good shape, didn't need any capital, they were fine. And then right on the heels of AIG, they put them into bankruptcy. They wipe out all of the preferred stock and all of the common stock. Thousands of small banks around the country had been encouraged to buy preferred stock in Freddie and Fannie, and it was considered riskless. The regulators gave it a 20% risk weighting. A loan to Bill Isaac has 100% risk weighting. A loan to Freddie or Fannie had a 20% risk weighting. So the regulators were encouraging banks to invest in Freddie and Fannie. And anyway, they took it down. They wiped out the common and the preferred, which caused a lot of problems for community banks around the country in particular. I think 2,500 banks had really big investments. I don't know the exact numbers. Had really big investments in Fannie and Freddie, and that caused a lot of our community bank failures. And then they decided to bail out Wachovia by merging it into Citi. Now, that never happened because Wells Fargo came along and said, we'll buy it without FDIC assistance. But they were going to merge Wachovia into Citigroup. I mean, Citi was having enough problems. It sure didn't need Wachovia's problems. But that's what they decided to do. And then Wells Fargo came along and bought Wachovia without FDIC involvement. And then WaMu is on the verge of failure, and they let it go down. Well, they actually merged it into J.P. Morgan Chase, but they wiped out $20 billion of bondholders in Wachovia, and worse yet, they wiped out $7 billion of fresh equity that had just been put into that institution a few months before by the Bonderman to Texas Pacific Gas Group. They put in $7 billion of fresh equity. Now, what is it, government, that makes you think that you should allow some private investor to come in and put $7 billion in an institution that you know is going to fail, that the $7 billion is not enough. Now, I think that's irresponsible. Not too smart on the part of the investor group, but irresponsible on the part of the government to allow people to put $7 billion into an institution that they either knew or should have known was going to fail. And then on Fannie and Freddie, you know, I mean, I got to tell you, I didn't take any confidence when they tell me for 6 months that Freddie and Fannie are fine, and then they dump them into a conservatorship over a weekend. That makes me think, I have to ask, was the government ignorant when they said those were okay, or were they lying to us? And I'm not sure which of those frightens me more. I think ignorance frightens me more than the lie. So all of that was getting on my nerves, and then they proposed TARP, taking $700 billion of our money and putting it into Wall Street firms to buy toxic assets. It was a very bad idea. I was very opposed to it. Wrote an article in the Washington Post that appeared on September 27, 2008, opposing TARP, saying there is a better way. And that article suggested four things we could do, and I won't worry about it right now, that would be a lot better than TARP, and that TARP was a very bad idea. It wouldn't work, and it would cost taxpayers hundreds of billions of dollars. A number of members of Congress called me from both parties, from all ends of the political spectrum, asking me if I would come to Washington that weekend and talk to them about TARP. I said, no, my wife and I and the kids are going to watch the Buccaneers beat the Packers, and you guys are going to pass that terrible bill, and I can't stop it, so I'd rather not waste my weekend. Well, they persisted, and so finally I said, okay, I'll talk to my wife when she gets home, and she came home, and she said, you got to go. And I said, why? It's not going to do any good. And she said, because you'll hate yourself if you don't. You really care. Go try to do what you can. So that's what I did. This book is the result of all that. I talked to hundreds of members of Congress. We actually defeated TARP on the first vote in the House, thanks to all of the conversations we had that weekend. And then the administration and the leaders in the Congress put the heat on some of those who voted against it in the House and forced them to change their votes, so that they did get TARP passed. And I would tell you that TARP did not work. TARP was not even implemented. 2 weeks after TARP was enacted, the Treasury said, that's a bad idea. And they never bought any of the toxic assets. Instead, they forced the largest banks around the country to take capital from the taxpayers, most of which the banks did not want. I mean, there were banks that simply were opposed to it. They did not want it, and they were forced to take it. And it's given the industry a black eye. It's caused an incredible political backlash that is continuing to this day. It's caused our industry, the banking industry, enormous problems. And so I think that TARP was a horrible idea. It did not work. It was not even used. And it caused enormous damage. It caused an enormous political backlash that's going to cause the banking industry to suffer for years. And I would tell you that you cannot have a strong economy without a strong banking system, and you can't have a strong banking system without a strong economy. The two are really interlinked. And when we decide to do these attacks against the banking system, we really are hurting ourselves. We need to get this banking system turned around and straightened out and headed in the right direction. We need to put it under better supervision and regulation than it's ever had. And that's what we should have been doing in the way of reforms. The Dodd-Frank bill is a sham. It didn't do anything to change the problems in our financial system and to prevent the next crisis. And it's time to get some new leadership in Washington that's going to do what it takes to get these problems fixed. We can fix these problems.
Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to throw away all the questions that came in because he just answered in the last 3 minutes. Seriously, one quick story. I am going to tell another story. When the FBI was researching this guy before he became chairman of the FDIC, they went to the managing partner of the law firm that Bill had been with, and they asked a bunch of questions. You know, it's the same old, does he use drugs? No. Does he have a mistress? No. Is he happy with his wife? Yes. Does he have...
Well, that was a lie, but...
All right, here's the big one. Does he have an alcohol problem? And all three of the FBI people listened very carefully as the managing partner said, yes. And the guy said, "What? What? He doesn't drink."
Okay, okay. I'm told that's a true story. I have a question here from a student. We like to have the students get a first crack at this. Here, this one. What fiscal policies do you believe Congress should set forth in our current economic state?
Fiscal policy.
Fiscal.
Okay. Stop spending so damn much money. That's it. I mean, we have a fiscal crisis in this country that's going to take us down. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff has said publicly that if we don't get this federal spending under control and get these deficits down, we will not be able to afford our military. In just a few years, we will not be able to afford our military. This is a serious, serious problem that we are facing. We're just about as bad as Italy and the other countries in Europe that are having these problems. The reason why we can get away with it longer is, of course, the dollar is the world's currency. And the Fed has created about $2 trillion of excess reserves in the banking system so far, just pumping money out, keeping rates around zero. That is not going to solve the problem. In fact, that is leading us, I fear, into a period of serious inflation. Now, I was chairman of the FDIC during the last round of serious inflation, and I just described to you the damage that caused throughout this country. And I don't want to see that again. And so it's really time that the Bowles-Simpson Commission, which Obama appointed, came out with a plan to fix the fiscal crisis. And it had bipartisan support, still does have bipartisan support. Now, it may not be a perfect plan, but it is a great starting point. And what we need to do is to get our leaders from both parties together and enact that plan. And it called for $4 or $5 trillion of spending cuts, with a lot of it coming by changing the rules on entitlement programs out into the future. Not, you know, I think anybody over 50 is exempted, but we've got to change these plans for the future. And they also recommend that we go to a flatter tax code, flatter tax rates, and eliminate most deductions, if not all. And it will be fair because everybody's going to be paying the taxes. And, you know, the rich aren't going to find a lot of loopholes because we're going to eliminate most of the deductions. It's going to be a lot fairer tax code, and it's going to raise a lot more revenue. And because the rates are lower, it's going to stimulate the economy. That's the main cure to the fiscal problem. We have to get America growing again. And that requires certainty. I got to tell you, all my life I have been invested in the stock market since I was mowing lawns in high school, okay? That's what I was taught to do. You work hard, you save, you invest your money. And I'm afraid to invest right now. I think everybody is. Because what's going to happen? Are we going to have inflation? Are they going to raise our tax rates? Is the economy going to grow? Is the government going to take over more and more of the economy and impose more and more regulatory burden? How can you invest in that environment? How can you even feel comfortable spending in that environment? And that is what is impeding economic growth. We are not investing, and we are not spending because they have us frightened. And if you're not frightened right now, you're not paying attention.
I'm glad I'm not a small businessman now trying to decide whether I should invest more money in my business, too. It's part of what you're saying. We have several questions on Dodd-Frank, about three or four. I think you covered that, but... The bottom line is, did it solve the problem? But too big to fail problem, or solve the problem? Well, probably not. If not, how do we solve it? That's the bottom line on a couple of the questions on Dodd-Frank.
Okay. Let me just say that I'll answer this question, but also if I know these cards are up here, and we'll try to get through as many as we can, and if something comes up in my answers here and you have something you want to say or ask, stick your hand up in the air. We'll try to deal with those too. Dodd-Frank, it was a colossal failure. It was a political document. The Congress approved the TARP, as I said, which was hugely unpopular throughout the land, rightly so. And so they had to atone themselves. And so what they did is they rushed a bill through the Dodd-Frank Reform Act to try to tell the public, we fixed everything. It's not going to happen again. And we understand you're angry, so we fixed everything. The truth is they rushed through a document that didn't, that would not have prevented this last crisis, would not have prevented it, will not prevent the next crisis. In fact, will make it harder, more difficult to deal with the next crisis. And they did it simply because they needed to get something out there, they felt, before the election, last year's election, in order to make the public less angry. Well, it didn't work. And we're still angry, and we're more angry, because we know it didn't work. Now, let's talk about too big to fail. The five largest financial institutions in this country control over 50% of the financial assets. Okay? That's B of A, JP, Citi, B of A, and Goldman, I think, are the five largest. Wells Fargo. Are the five largest. If one of them got, let's say the sun's shining, everything's great in the economy, and one of them gets in trouble, you could probably figure out how to deal with that without bailing it out. You could say, okay, now you're going to make these changes and these changes, downsize, all this sort of stuff, and you could probably figure out how to deal with that without asking for taxpayer money to bail it out. The FDIC and the Fed could probably get their arms around it and figure out how to wind it down over time. But that's not the way problems happen in the financial system. These banks are so big, and they're so diverse, and they're in so many things that when one of them is, they're all in the same things. So when one of them is in trouble, you can bet that most of them are in trouble, or many of them are in trouble. And there is no way that you can deal, let's say four of them are coming at you at the same time. There is no way that you can say, let's let those four guys fail. You can't do it. It would destroy the economy. They own half of the economy. You would absolutely wipe out the economy. And they're kidding themselves. Actually, they aren't, because the real leaders in Washington, the people who are going to have to handle a crisis, know that if several of these big ones get into trouble at the same time, they will not be allowed to fail. They know that. Even if it takes a new law of Congress and more taxpayer allocation of money, they will not be allowed to fail. What we have to do, if we're going to try to get some market discipline into place, is kind of what the Fed did with Bear Stearns the first time, when it said, here's $30 billion. They loaned it to JP and told them to loan it to Bear Stearns. Here's $30 billion or $50 billion, whatever it is. The Fed can write some pretty big checks. Here it is. Let's get this thing stabilized. And after the crisis, and it may be not just one, it may be four or five of them. Let's get them stabilized. After the economy has settled down, after the crisis has settled down, we will go in and find out which of them should survive and which ones we should put out of their misery. We'll go in and examine them carefully, figure out which ones are insolvent, which ones just got into a liquidity crisis, and we'll make that distinction. And the ones that are truly insolvent, we'll get rid of them. That's what they have to do. The Dodd-Frank law took away all that authority. The FDIC and the Fed can't do that today because of Dodd-Frank.
Another question related to something we call Glass-Steagall. Do you think that should be reinstated or some form thereto?
Glass-Steagall is a law that was put into place. It was enacted in 1933 and was effective in 1934. In response to the Great Depression, and we had a lot of abuses that were going on in the banking system. Glass-Steagall separated commercial banking from Wall Street investment banking. I always say it separated Main Street from Wall Street. And the theory behind Glass-Steagall was that a lot of banks, Citi in particular, was in the news a lot back then. They had these, I think it's called the Pecoria hearings, and they criticized Citi because Citi was selling securities in its clients to the markets, you know, having issuances of securities, using the proceeds to pay off Citibank loans, which were lousy loans. Okay, that was the abuse, that the same firm shouldn't be selling securities to the public that is lending money to these institutions. Because they're going to the public and having the public bail out their bad loans. That was the alleged abuse. And that's why they enacted Glass-Steagall. Now, Over the years, Glass-Steagall was eroded, and in 1999, we repealed it. I was in favor of repeal because I thought, number one, we were smart enough that we could regulate the abuses, that we could really get on top of the abuses and keep those things from happening. And secondly, if we allow these two industries to come together, that we would create more competition and better pricing for businesses that had to borrow and issue securities. I thought it would increase competition and lower prices. I think that was a mistake. And I believe that, I mean, there are people who feel strongly that we shouldn't have Glass-Steagall. I believe that what we needed in 2009 and 2010 was a real serious debate on Glass-Steagall. And get people testifying and trying to explore what's the best answer here. Dodd-Frank totally ignored the issue. Didn't do anything about it, and so now we're still left here wondering what to do about Glass-Steagall. We shouldn't have to ask that question today. Congress should have been thinking about it and dealing with it, but they didn't. They also didn't deal with Fannie and Freddie, which is a 10,000-pound gorilla sitting
That's
there.
That's my next question.
Should Fannie and Freddie be phased out? Yes.
Next question.
Actually, Dick Kovacevich, who was chairman of Wells Fargo for a long time, a really great guy and a great banker, and I have written an article which should appear any day now, I hope, in either the Washington Post or the Wall Street Journal, in which we make the case for phasing out Fannie and Freddie. There is no other major country in the world that has a Fannie and Freddie. We're the home of the free enterprise system and capitalism, and we have our government totally wrapped up in the housing industry in a way no other major country does. And it's time to phase out Fannie and Freddie. It's not needed, and it's probably cost us taxpayers $300 billion, and they still don't get it. They're still guaranteeing loans that have no down payments. They're still paying themselves $10 million bonuses, even as they ask Congress for more billions. Okay? They don't get it, and we have to phase them out. And it's quite possible to phase them out. It's not going to be disruptive. Wells Fargo is probably the largest, if not maybe the second largest, home lender in the world. So Kovacevich knows an awful lot about the housing market. And we are absolutely convinced, Dick and I, that we can phase out Fannie and Freddie, and the markets will work extremely well without them, better without them.
I want to mention something I failed to mention earlier. Bill writes many, many articles. I think over the last few years, probably 200-300 different articles in newspapers. You pick one: New York Times, Washington Post, Chicago Tribune, American Banker. Just start ticking them off. He's been on every major network news program domestically and many in foreign countries. He's been a speaker worldwide, covering just some of the issues we've been fortunate to hear about today from him. So again, I want to say thanks for showing up. It's been delightful. But before you leave, be sure and leave your name tags in the baskets at the door. And we do have a book presentation to Bill Isaac.